You're listening to The College Connection from New England Public Radio. The College Connection is a series of lectures from visiting and local speakers given and recorded at the five colleges. This forum provides an opportunity for listeners to engage with the researchers, intellectuals, authors, and poets active within our academic communities. Nancy McLean is a professor of history and public policy at Duke University, a fellow of the Society of American Historians, and the award-winning author of many books, most recently the 2017 National Book Award finalist Democracy in Chains, which Booklist called perhaps the best explanation to date of the roots of the political divide that threatens to irrevocably alter American government. In her talk at the University of Massachusetts on November 13, 2017, McLean shared the story of how she reached her conclusions and explained their significance.
I'm so happy to be here at UMass. I can't tell you what it meant to me when Jerry Epstein wrote to me and said nice things about my book and asked me to come, because it was at the time when many of these libertarian economists were saying quite different things from the ones Jerry wrote to me. And I was absolutely thrilled to come here because the reputation of UMass is certainly national and probably international for the amazing progressive policy work that you all do, as well as cutting-edge scholarship. So I was thrilled by that. And then I was delighted when Laura Briggs started organizing history departments to be part of the visit too. So anyway, really happy to be here with you on this lovely campus. And I wish that I could keep speaking in this very positive vein, but I'm here to talk to you about other matters, and matters that I'm sure you're all becoming uncomfortably aware of, in that over the last year in particular, it has become ever more obvious that American politics are in crisis. Most obviously in Washington, but also in the states. And a government that was supposed to be of, by, and for the people is in crisis. And even elementary norms of civic decency and truth are in crisis. You know this. I think that's part of the reason why you're here today. But what you might be struggling to figure out is how we reached this point and what that means. The watershed that we've reached in our public life now has been fed by many streams, of course, and some of those have received extensive and really scintillating attention from scholars and from journalists. Those streams include the kind of movement conservatism that made Barry Goldwater, the Republican candidate for president in 1964, just after his vote against the Civil Rights Act of that year. Another and related stream is the religious right, and there is the white supremacist right, which has resurfaced with a vengeance of late. All of these are important and have produced the votes to effect radical policy change. But I'm here today to talk about another piece of the puzzle of how we got to the dangerous situation in which we now find ourselves. A missing piece, and that is the ideas that are guiding the billionaire-funded libertarian right, made popular or notorious, depending on your perspective, by Charles Koch. And I believe that this is a crucial piece that we've missed because it explains so much that otherwise remains mysterious. It's also crucial because knowing how we arrived at the situation that we're in now may equip citizens like all of you here to lead the way out of this mess before it is too late. As a public health nurse reader who read Democracy in Chains expressed it, you need to get the diagnosis right before you can determine the best treatment plan. And I love that. I think that's a perfect analogy for the work that historians are sometimes called upon to do. And I say that also because I think there's an unmarked hazard in our situation right now in the United States. The noisiest threats are getting the most attention, among them the chronic race baiting and bullying coming from the White House. But as that spectacle draws nearly all media and voter attention, an even more extreme plan is moving along apace. In the 30 states that are now totally dominated by this cause through a radicalized Republican Party that has become a delivery vehicle for it, I will talk more about that as we go on, in federal agencies and in the courts. This plan is being pursued by a much smaller cause, but one that is archly determined and breathtakingly well-funded. And this cause's architects aim to rewrite the rules of our society permanently. More than that, they have shown that they are willing to use those other popular sections of the right, particularly the religious right and the white supremacist right, to get what they want. I'll state my case simply. Behind all the seeming chaos and dysfunction in our public life right now, there is a strategy in play, a cold-eyed, calculated strategy. And that strategy is far along. As one of its field generals said in late 2015, and I quote, "We're close to winning. They," he was speaking of the critics, but we could also say the rest of us, "they don't have the real path." That was Mark Holden, the head of Koch Industries' government and public affairs operation, gloating to an invitation-only audience of billionaire and multimillionaire donors. Now, you've heard a great deal over the last several years, if you've been following the news, about the fortune that Charles Koch has been investing in an effort to transform our politics. But what you've likely not heard about is the ideas, the technology, as Koch refers to them. And this is a man with 3 engineering degrees from MIT, a man who is much smarter than many of his critics understand, and who thinks of ideas as technology. What you've heard less about, I would imagine, is the ideas that have lately made these investments so devastatingly effective. And Charles Koch, by 1997, a point that I'll come back to later on, had already been funding thinkers for 3 decades before he settled on the ideas that he believed would get him what he wanted. And so this is a project long in the making. And it was an academic economist, I learned through my research, who taught Charles Koch that for capitalism of the variety that they wanted to see to thrive, democracy must be enchained. So my book, Democracy in Chains, provides the unknown backstory of this defining moment in which we find ourselves, as it uncovers also that real path to which Mark Holden referred. In its essence, the book is the story of 2 men, a thinker and a CEO, whose lives converged through a shared commitment to transform the model of government that our country built up over the 20th century with citizen pressure, social movement after social movement. The thinker was a Tennessee-born economist, James McGill Buchanan, a man who spent most of his life in Virginia public institutions, ironically. And the CEO is, of course, the Kansas-backed Charles Koch, who spent most of his adult life, when he wasn't making Koch Industries into one of the largest privately held corporations in the world, now operating in 60 countries, Charles Koch spent most of his leisure time trying to find a way to make our country and the world, in fact, we'll come back to that, conform to his arch vision of economic liberty, a free-reign capitalism that would be beyond the reach of voters and their governments. The history that my book conveys is first of the crucible in which James Buchanan came up with this idea of enchaining democracy to insulate economic liberty, and that crucible happened to be Virginia in the civil rights era, as that movement was finally opening the state of Virginia to inclusive democracy and beginning to shape the politics of the wider country. And then the book is a story of how Koch funded an apparatus to make this idea of enchaining democracy a reality in a messianic quest that has produced the volatile situation that we are now confronting. And I have to admit up front, it is not a comforting story. I have had several readers compare the book to a Stephen King novel. I've never read a Stephen King novel. I suspect that might be a stretch, but I think that what they were getting at is that it is a scary story. And I admit that. I felt very unsettled myself as I was doing this research many times. But I do believe, both as a scholar and a citizen, that understanding what we're really up against is vital to assessing how best to defend a democracy that many of us now understand is facing existential threat. I do believe that knowledge can be empowering, and I am happy that that is what I'm hearing from readers, including one here today, but others who are saying things like, it feels like the curtain has been pulled back and now we can finally see what is going on. That things that seemed mysterious before seem to make more sense. Rather than lecture in a conventional way at this point, I thought what I'd rather do is share with you the story of how I stumbled on the trail that led me to these conclusions. And I do mean stumble. There are a lot of contingencies in this story. And I think that knowing the route that led me to the fairly stark conclusions I've just shared with you will also give you a better sense of the stakes of all of this. Because it turns out that what we're seeing now in 2017 is not the first time that the libertarian right has shown itself willing to exploit white supremacy to advance the cause of what I've come to think about as property supremacy, a property supremacy that will ultimately affect all of us. The trail that led me to these conclusions also reveals the surprising role that some scholars and universities have played in bringing us to this point, and that, I think, is a history that all of us in educational settings need to know about and to reckon with. Okay, so what led me to the conclusions I've just put out? In a word, serendipity, accident. As has been said, I am a historian of social movements in the U.S., the history of social movements, with a particular focus on the U.S. South. And about 10 years ago, I had just finished another book, and I came across the tragic tale of Prince Edward County, Virginia. I happened to be in Philadelphia, and I stopped at the archives of the American Friends Service Committee, a group that many of you may know. And there I found documentation of a story that I was actually embarrassed that I did not know as a historian whose work has involved the South. And what happened in Prince Edward County is that white county officials answered the Supreme Court's, U.S. Supreme Court's call to desegregate its public schools without further delay by, as the county leaders put it, going out of the public school business entirely. They shuttered their entire public school system. They even posted no trespassing signs on many of the doors of the schools. And they left black children with no formal education whatsoever while they sent the county's white children off to a private segregation academy with state-subsidized tuition grants, what we would call vouchers. The county officials kept the public schools closed for 5 years until the courts forced them to reinstate a public school system. Shocked by this story and deeply moved by the stories I found in the archives from the children who were affected, from their parents, and from the civil rights activists who were working with them, I started to research, and in very short order, I found that these tax-funded state school vouchers were crucial to the story, crucial to this white resistance, so I started to follow them. And I learned that Milton Friedman, the famed University of Chicago economist, had issued his first manifesto for such school vouchers in 1955. In the full knowledge of how such vouchers would be used in the South. The news had been coming up from Southern states, from the most arch segregationists, from 1951 forward as these cases were filed that flowed into Brown, with some of the most arch segregationists saying they would end public education before they would allow black and white students to sit next to one another in schools. And so Friedman produced this manifesto in this context, and I also know that he understood the context because he was challenged by his editor, who is a liberal economist, who asked all the questions that you or I would, and Friedman would have none of it. He proceeded with his manifesto, and so he became part of my story. And for a good while, I thought I was actually following the story of Friedman and his involvement in Virginia, because after all, he was the famous one. He was the one who appeared in all the books about neoliberalism. He was the one that we knew. But in following a footnote, I learned of a 1959 report as this threat from Prince Edward County officials was in the air to shut the schools in September by two other economists who had set up a center at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville in 1956, just after the passage of the massive resistance laws. And one of these men was James McGill Buchanan. And what the two economists were doing with this report was trying to refute a movement, this time among white moderates, including some of their own colleagues at the University of Virginia, by the way, but most particularly of white parents and moderate clergy who were trying to save Virginia's public school system. And there's a long story there. I won't go into all the detail of it, but one of the ways that they were making the case to save the school system was saying that Virginia already had a very poorly funded system of public schools. If they started draining resources off to private schools, they would have a terrible education system, and so these private school vouchers should not stand. Well, Buchanan and his colleague used the language of their discipline to answer that charge and basically said that the moderates were getting the math wrong. And they weren't factoring in what would happen if you sold off all the public school buildings and resources to private operators. And so essentially they said, and they made the kind of case that you see today in the pro-voucher community for how these private schools would end the monopoly, the government monopoly of education. They would provide better education choice, et cetera. So in effect, their report called for privatizing Virginia's public schools before privatizing as a verb had entered our national vocabulary. And they did so in the full knowledge that the schools thus funded would be white segregation academies, because those were the only private schools in question. in this period. And Black parents and their organizations, such as the NAACP and others, had made clear that they opposed this voucher system, and they took it as an affront to the equal citizenship rights that had just been acknowledged in Brown. And they opposed them to a person, though you could not find Black parents who would take these vouchers. So, needless to say, as a university professor myself, it stunned me to see two university professors making a case for what their state's most arch segregationists were seeking in a group called the Defenders of State Sovereignty and Individual Liberty, was the Virginia equivalent of the White Citizens' Councils. And it intrigued me that these economists did so not in racist terms, but in economic terms. They leveraged the authority of their discipline to back up what the most right-wing, anti-democratic figures of the day were calling for. Buchanan and his colleague Warren Nutter, who submitted this report, knew that they were exploiting the rage of white supremacists to move their libertarian economic agenda, an agenda they referred to as the free society, even as they showed no sympathy whatsoever for the civil rights activists whose mantra, after all, was freedom now. They sent this report to, I believe it was 90 members of the state legislature, all the people who are going to be on this new commission to find out a solution. This copy that I found was in the papers of someone who had sponsored 5 laws against the NAACP to take away First Amendment rights from NAACP members. And they said in their cover letter to this legislator that they were issuing this report, quote, letting the chips fall where they may. Letting the chips fall where they may. And that phrase has just kind of lodged itself in my gut and made me wonder who these people were and how anyone could do a thing like this, not in irrational frenzy, the kind of thing you saw happening in Mississippi or Alabama or southern Georgia, not irrational frenzy, but cold-eyed calculation. My curiosity piqued. I began seeking more information about this James Buchanan, whom I had never heard of when I started this project. I didn't set out looking for him. You could say he found me. And I learned that he had won the Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences in 1986. He was awarded that prize for having founded a new way of thinking called public choice economics, which also, I learned, became very influential in political science and law and among activists and elected officials on the right. What Buchanan did that was new in his terms was what he called the economic analysis of politics. Now, folks here, many people in the audience know that he's not the first one to do the economic analysis of politics. Some people may remember Charles Beard's economic analysis of the American Constitution, or Karl Marx had an economic analysis of politics. But Buchanan's was distinctive, and what he did was to apply Chicago School libertarian economics to political actors to argue that they could only be understood as individuals who were rationally seeking their own personal self-interest in the public realm, not the common good as they claimed. And that led Buchanan to a new explanation of deficits that proved very persuasive to many because he made sense of something that Keynesian economists had not, and that was why governments would overspend in times of prosperity, not just depression or recession. And Buchanan's own specialty was public finance, so he was deeply concerned with questions of taxation and of government spending. And as a political thinker who identified with the right, his mission became finding new ways to lower taxes and reduce the public sector. And with this public choice economics, he turned new attention to what he liked to call the rules of the game in politics, to the spending incentives of the political process, and to how altering the rules of that process might yield different outcomes. And here I want to say that there are other people since who are not on the right who have found heuristic value in public choice economics. One of them is Cass Sunstein, a Harvard Law professor who worked on regulatory matters in the Obama administration and co-authored a book called Nudge that uses some insights from this field. So it's not only a right-wing phenomenon, it's a wider phenomenon. But Buchanan's version, the Virginia School of Political Economy, was always distinctive, I learned. And Buchanan himself said, looking back in a documentary in 2007, that when he set to work developing these ideas in the late 1950s, the idea of the public interest was dominant. And elected officials and others in public life would talk about trying to serve the common good or the public interest. And he said, that's what I wanted to tear down. Why would anyone want to tear down the idea of the public interest? I think most of us in this room understand that the public interest is not a thing like this water bottle, that it's actually something that arises out of deliberative democracy, that as we try to persuade one another of our views, and if you reach a majority and you begin to shape public policy, then we can say that you have identified a public interest and a common good that other people find compelling. But Buchanan did not share that kind of assumption, I learned as I read more. And I found that to a libertarian like him, there is no common good. Any notion of shared purpose will lead government, in their view, to coerce those who don't agree with the majority. Democracy, Buchanan and his colleagues came to argue, violates the individual liberty of the minority. And the minority, the only minority I could find over the years that he was seriously concerned with, was the wealthy minority, the minority of wealthy taxpayers and corporations who didn't share the majority public's view of the public interest and the common good. And the government, Buchanan and his colleagues, came to argue, all but steals the property of such unwilling taxpayers if it levies taxes on them for purposes that they don't share. Essentially, he was at pains to insist that we are not our brother's keepers. Or at least that we should not be allowed to use government to shift tax resources from one citizen to another. And he came to talk about all of this in very stark and foreboding terms, terms that are now widespread on the right, owing to decades of inculcation by Buchanan's team and the think tanks with which they worked. A case in point, many of you may remember when candidate Mitt Romney in 2012 on the campaign trail spoke to an audience of donors who had paid $50,000 a plate to hear him speak, spoke disdainfully of what he called the 47% of Americans he said would never vote for him because they were too dependent on government as net tax recipients. And when he did that, millions of Americans were shocked. Some people thought that actually lost him the election. But in fact, Romney was not expressing a new idea in that. That was a Buchananite idea that had been around for some time, and by the time he said it, the Heritage Foundation was maintaining what it calls the annual index of dependency to chart this notion of who are the people who are net tax recipients. And it was Buchanan who gave scholarly imprimatur to such thinking. And he also spoke of net tax recipients, again, people who get more from government than they pay in. He spoke of them in such stark terms as, in a quote, parasites on the productive. He warned of predators and prey. By predators, he meant people like senior citizens seeking a drug benefit, civil rights activists who wanted anti-discrimination measures, public teachers or health workers who wanted to increase the budgets of their schools or their services and so forth. Those were the predators, and the prey were these unwilling wealthy taxpayers and corporate taxpayers. And I think you can see in that language of parasites and predators and prey a kind of dehumanizing vocabulary that it's really important, particularly in our present moment, to point out because it's a vocabulary with which Buchanan made fellow citizens, doing what citizens have done since the founding of this country, bring appeals to government for public purposes, made them appear as menaces from the animal world. And I know from my first book on the hard right that this is a vocabulary that is disinhibiting, a vocabulary that licenses hostility. And I think all of us can see it is a vocabulary that is now rife on the right in America. As I read more, I learned, too, that for those who think this way, justice is a simple matter. As one of Buchanan's colleagues put it, Walter Williams, who sometimes guest hosts for Rush Limbaugh. Walter Williams said, he said this recently in the campaign trail in North Carolina in one of their think tanks, let me offer you my definition of social justice. I keep what I earn and you keep what you earn. And the idea there is that you collectively can only tax me if I agree with all your goals and methods. But Buchanan himself did not stop there, did not stop with that kind of analysis. Believing this way and believing quite strongly in the views he was propounding, he moved in the 1970s from scholarship to organizing. He began urging right-wing donors and people in politics, including Ed Meese, then Governor Ronald Reagan's chief of staff and top advisors, that they needed to build a counterintelligentsia. That was the word that Buchanan used before others. And he also argued that they needed to create, again, his words, a gravy train. They needed to create a gravy train, as he put it, to train men in a set of values and to bring them in to this libertarian cause and train them, basically, for intellectual battle. And as he organized, as he tried to bring together this counterintelligentsia, he also shifted from analysis to prescription. He began working more and more in what he called constitutional economics, in the belief that all existing constitutions were failures, according to him, on the measure of whether they protected this wealthy minority from predation by their fellow citizens. In the belief that all existing constitutions were failures, he set out to design a legal regime that could protect capitalism from government, that could enshrine the rights of the wealthy minority to a degree that no society anywhere had ever yet done. And his timing in working on this in the mid-1970s was quite propitious. He found an eager audience for his ideas among some generals in need of a new constitution in Chile. In 1980, the military junta of General Augusto Pinochet, through its civilian partners in the Chilean corporate world, invited Buchanan to Santiago to try out his ideas for how to devise such a constitution to protect capitalism from government. And what they were trying to do, these generals, is they understood they had already overthrown an elected government. They had killed thousands of people. They had undermined the labor unions. They had destroyed the rural farmers and rural workers unions. They had undermined freedom in the universities and students' organizations. But they knew they were going to have to go back to elected rule at some point for Chile's development model to be viable. So they wanted to figure out how to have a constitution that would let them do that while keeping in place all that they had achieved through the dictatorship, including privatizing education, healthcare, and Social Security pensions. So they invited Buchanan. And the result of his advice and Chilean input in something called the Constitution of Liberty, the result is still in effect today. And in 2013, a president, Michelle Bachelet, who had been elected by two-thirds of the Chilean people on a wide-ranging reform program after up to a million students had been in the streets about what had been done to their education system. This is in a much smaller country than ours. She was elected on this wide-ranging reform program, and when she got to office, she realized this constitution was keeping her from delivering on what people wanted her to do and sent her to office to do. And she complained of what she called the authoritarian trammels of this constitution, and she said that Chileans needed a constitution without locks and bolts. Now, I think it's important to pause here and say something that should be obvious, but apparently isn't to some of my libertarian critics. All of us who believe in democracy, I don't think anybody believes in totally unrestricted democracy. You know, we need checks and balances to protect human rights, to protect minorities from abuse. We would not have had the Brown decision had there not been checks and balances. So we're not talking about checks and balances here in the kind of constitution Buchanan was recommending. We are talking about locks and bolts to shackle the will of the people. And I'm sorry to report that this Chilean story is not of purely historical interest. It's more a case of past as prologue. Because that kind of constitution of locks and bolts is now coming to America thanks to pressure from the Koch donor network and its allies in the trenches who are determined to achieve the binding restraints on government that Buchanan urged without informing the public of their true goals. And thanks to assiduous organizing by the apparatus that these arch-right donors fund, above all the American Legislative Exchange Council and Republican Party that the donors have all but taken over and turned into a delivery vehicle with the threat of primary challenges, this cause of constitutional transformation now has in place 28 of the 34 states needed to call a Section 5 constitutional convention under Section 5 of the Constitution. It's a story that has not, it's gotten some coverage, but not nearly the coverage that it needs. And it is really important for people to be aware that this is unprecedented, okay? We have not had a constitutional convention since 1787, when the document was crafted by people who did something other than what they were sent to do. You will probably know, being out here in the Northeast. But this donor network is pushing hard for this kind of constitutional convention. Wisconsin was just the latest state to authorize one in last week's elections. And so this is an incredibly radical effort, and it is possibly a few years away at the rate that things are going. Now, you might be wondering how I was... A crucial part of my book and what I found in my research is that this donor network is pushing this process precisely because they understand that they are, in Charles Koch's words, greatly outnumbered in their ideas. And so their failure to use these ideas to gain an advantage to achieve what they want will keep them from success. Okay, so you might be wondering how I was able to put together the way that Buchanan's ideas were guiding what Mark Holden called the real path that this Koch donor network is following to shackle our democracy. And the answer is, again, coincidence. I moved to North Carolina in 2010, and at that point I was still focused on Milton Friedman and the school story. This guy Buchanan interested me. I was trying to figure out what went on in Chile, what he did there, but I was still focusing on the other things. And then I moved to North Carolina in the fall of 2010, just as a radicalized Republican Party, dominated by Koch-backed Tea Party figures, won majorities in both houses of the North Carolina state legislature. As I watched the rollout when this radicalized new Republican majority took power, suddenly I could see these things that I was reading about in Buchanan's work that still seemed very abstract becoming concrete and very real as the North Carolina General Assembly's lead donor, this man Art Pope, boasted of the, as he called it, big bang his grantees were developing to make this once moderate state, again a boast, a laboratory for the cause using what this technology from public choice economics. Okay, so what did I see happening in this big bang that really rolled out like the military doctrine of shock and awe, where there were so many changes coming so rapidly on so many directions that people were just overwhelmed, as they were intended to be, I now understand. But Buchanan had long urged the people he worked with, libertarian scholars, libertarian think tanks, donors, that if you wanted to see radical change, you had to stop focusing on this question of who rules, the particular personalities in power, and start focusing on the rules, right? And if you wanted to see radical transformation that the libertarians did, you had to focus laser-like on systematically changing the rules of governance. Chile had certainly done this. Now the thinking was about how to do this in democratic conditions. And what I watched unfold in North Carolina after 2010 was a stunning barrage of radical rules changes on this model, one after another. They included extreme gerrymandering, the most radical gerrymander in our history, to misrepresent the will of voters. They included new measures to undermine workers' ability to come together to organize in unions, particularly public sector unions. They included attacks on public education at all levels and radical cuts in funding for public education while siphoning off public tax dollars to charter schools that one shock judge said were under no legal obligation to teach students anything. And one chain did exactly that, teaching students nothing in math for 180 days, according to the tests done. That also included repeal of a hard-won racial justice act to ensure fairness in policing and in the Criminal Justice Act, included refusal to accept the Medicaid expansion of the Affordable Care Act despite a crying need in our low-wage state among workers who made too much to qualify for Medicaid but too little to afford health care on their own. It included rolling back measures to protect the environment and reduce global warming. And also in method, this was all new. They broke with customary governing practices like public hearings before passing significant legislation, like transparency about the process. Much of this was done by skullduggery, one measure taking rights from teachers after midnight in the General Assembly. And instead, they were moving with breakneck speed and secrecy. And then, to cap it all off, they passed in 2013, when they were no longer afraid of a veto by a Democratic governor, they passed what has come to be known among critical North Carolinians as the Monster Voter Suppression Act, a voter suppression act that had some 15 different elements to keep people who would vote against this agenda away from the polls. They also wanted to keep young people away from the polls because they're afraid that young people don't share this agenda. So we can talk more about the ways that they were keeping young people from voting, but that's important to point out. What proved so surreal to me watching this, both as a scholar and as a citizen, was that I could see that this new Republican majority was implying insights from Buchanan's ideas to get what they otherwise could not, certainly not if they had campaigned openly on supporting the measures they were pushing through. But also unsettling was watching how critics of all of this, including people I knew, good, well-intentioned people who were shocked at the U-turn that their beloved state was taking, and North Carolinians love their state, they were missing the deep operational strategy that unified all of these varied measures. And they couldn't see that the men who were pushing this agenda were not misinformed about the likely consequences of the agenda that they were promoting. These men fully understood that would inflict grievous harm on their fellow citizens, on the people who would die, and physicians and others were able to calculate how many people would die because of the lack of the Medicaid expansion, the students whose learning would be stunted by what was being done to the public schools. They understood all this, but they believed their endgame was worth that price. They were, you could say, in cold calculation, letting the chips fall where they may. And what my fellow critics of all this also could not see, even the brilliant Reverend Barber, who led something called the Moral Mondays movement, which I was part of, am part of, but what the critics were not seeing is that this agenda was backed by an ethical system that gave these political actors confidence and let them feel heroic enough to weather the criticism and opposition. And I understand why it was hard for people to understand that ethical system, particularly good moral people like Reverend Barber, because it's an ethical system that runs counter to all of the world's major religious traditions. But it is an ethical system, and it has its own stark coherence that we need to understand if we are going to know how to deal with the crisis that Buchanan's ideas and Koch's money have created for us. To wit, to make this very concrete, the libertarian morality deems it better to have people die from lack of health care than to receive it from government, from taxes paid for by others. And this really, ultimately, is what they mean when they talk about personal responsibility. Now, everybody in this room practices personal responsibility, right? From the time we answer our alarm clocks and get up and brush our teeth and make the sandwiches and do the other things that we do, we exercise personal responsibility. So it's kind of an insult to suggest that we don't. But what they're getting at with this personal responsibility is that in their dream society, you should be responsible for everything in your life. You should not be able to look to government for anything. In their dream society, you have an individual account for your education and your children's education. You have another account for your possible unemployment. You have another account for your health care. You have another account for your retirement, and on. But you don't have a right to think that your government should be able to help you in adversity. And I learned all of this and more in 2013 when James Buchanan died. And finally, that September, I got access to his private archive at George Mason University. And there, I found his records going back for his centers and his own personal correspondence going back to the 1950s. And as I read through that, I found my developing understanding of all of this confirmed. And I have to tell you, in a way that sometimes literally took my breath away. I had to tell myself, you know, as I was picking up these documents, breathe, Nancy, breathe, you know. And I will give you just one example of this. In his private office, I found stacked helter-skelter on a chair, a pile of documents that exposed how Charles Koch and operatives from some of the various organizations that Charles Koch funds or funded at the time and still does, and George Mason economics faculty and George Mason higher administration, how they had collaborated to establish a base camp for this very political project in a public university, George Mason, just across the Potomac from Washington, D.C., with a plan to wheel out this base camp to use it to advance their political project. And in fact, since the mid-1970s, Charles Koch had been giving to Buchanan's center at George Mason, as well as to the Law and Economics Center run by Henry Manny, some of you may know, a great entrepreneur in developing the field of law and economics, whom Buchanan had gotten hired as the dean of George Mason's law school. And Koch knew Buchanan's signature ideas, but it was only now, in the late 1990s, when Koch's mind was laser-focused on producing results, that he circled back to this Nobel laureate and decided the missing piece that he had been looking for through the years was to be found at George Mason. because there was only one thinker in this movement who did more than just elaborate on the vision of a just society laid out by Koch's intellectual heroes, Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich Hayek, both of whom were now deceased. Only James Buchanan had developed an operational strategy for how to get to that society, one that took as axiomatic what Buchanan and Koch understood viscerally, that the enduring impediment to the enactment of their political vision was the ability of the American people, through the power of their numbers, to reject this program. What was holding back the movement then, at that key moment in the late 1990s, 1997 to be specific, also became clear. A strategy to break that power, or at least debilitate it, the very approach that James Buchanan had spent years thinking about and developing. And I should say, it wasn't just James Buchanan that Charles Koch could count on at George Mason. There were several others, including Henry Manny, whose summer program for federal judges Charles Koch had been funding since the early 1970s. And by the time that Koch made this big gift to George Mason, more than 2 in every 5 sitting federal judges had participated in what they jokingly called Henry Manny Camp, a summer camp that trained a stunning 40% of the U.S. federal judiciary. 2 out of every 5 federal judges had been treated to this Koch-backed curriculum. Building on those earlier investments, in 1997, Koch gave a $10 million gift to support big new expanded James Buchanan Center for Political Economy. Koch and Buchanan were to be co-chairs of this campus center, according to the donor agreement, and Koch made clear in the speech that accompanied his money that he wanted bold steps. Buchanan's theory and implementation strategies were the right technology, to use Koch's favorite phrase, but the professor's team, Koch suggested, had not applied the tools forcefully enough to, as he put it, create winning strategies. The operatives that Koch put in place on the campus would. Working with organizations such as these, off campus. The irony here, we can pick it up if anybody's interested in the conclusion, but in order to do this, they had to push James Buchanan aside on his home ground. They dispensed with him when he raised objections to the way that they were using a center in his name at a university in such a highly politicized manner. Okay, so when I brought home the documents, the hundreds of documents that I'd copied at Buchanan House, and put them together with other sources, I found myself laying down pieces of a puzzle that astounded me, frankly, in its scope and its audacity. This is a project that now encompasses dozens of ostensibly separate national organizations, some of whose names may be familiar to you. The Cato Institute, the Heritage Foundation, the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, even the Federalist Society, Charles Koch provided seed money for by his own boast. If you include with those national organizations the state-level operations that make up something called the State Policy Network, like your own Pioneer Institute for Public Policy Research, if you include those, and you include the international affiliates of something called the Atlas Network, with operations, 450 operations now in over 90 countries, we're talking about hundreds of organizations working to radically alter government and society to bring this kind of unfettered free-reign capitalism into being without being honest with the people that that is in fact what they are seeking. And as a historian of the South, I came to realize something else, that the form of government that these men see as ideal liberty, as the free society of their dreams, would be a lot like mid-century Virginia in all but the state-mandated racial segregation. When James Buchanan set to work in Charlottesville in 1956 with an avowed mission to preserve liberty, that state had just been identified by the great political scientist V.O. Key as the most oligarchical state in the South and therefore in America. Next to Virginia, Key wrote, and this is a man with a sometimes wicked sense of humor, next to Virginia, he said, Mississippi is a hotbed of democracy. Think about it yourself in light of what I've said here and what you have seen unfold over nearly a decade now. What is the substance of James Buchanan's and Charles Koch's notion of liberty but mid-century Virginia? The state that V.O. Key said was subjected to the most thorough control by an oligarchy. This Koch network is now crafting the kinds of tools that preserved elite domination in Virginia onto the nation as a whole. Now, as I said, the state forced racial oppression would go, but I think we need to realize that everything else about the political economy of mid-century Virginia enacts this donor libertarian dream. And I'll give you some examples. The use of right-to-work laws and other ploys to keep working people powerless. The suspicion of public education as a source of subversion. The ability to fire dissenting public employees at will, targeting educators in particular if they challenge the political leadership. The insistence that government should not be allowed to stop discrimination. The deployment of states' rights legal arguments to prevent the federal government from promoting equal treatment. The regressive tax system and refusal to make forward-looking public investments. The opposition to Social Security and Medicare, which was led in Congress by Harry Byrd in the Senate and Howard Smith in the House of Representatives, another Virginian. And the parsimonious response to public needs of all kinds, from decent schools to public health and more. Also, voting rights restrictions to keep those unlikely to support this system away from the polls. In short, a series of rules that in combination ensured the uncontested sway of corporations and the wealthiest citizens. And that is what prevailed in Virginia at mid-century, and that is what this network is now bringing to America. And the question that I believe this stealth plan presents other Americans with, once we know it, is at one level quite simple. Is what this cause seeks the kind of world that we want to live in and the kind of world that we want to pass on to our children and to future generations? That, I believe, is the real public choice. Thank you.
Nancy McLean spoke at UMass Amherst on November 13th, 2017. Special thanks to all those who helped make the recording possible. You've been listening to The College Connection from New England Public Radio, a series of lectures from visiting and local speakers given and recorded at the five colleges. You can find more College Connection online at nepr.net or subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts. For New England Public Radio, I'm Dave Sears.